Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So in the 2010 book, Frank the Voice, we were told the story of Frank Sinatra's meteoric rise to fame, subsequent failures, and reinvention as a star of live performances and the big screen. The story of Old Blue Eyes continues with Sinatra, the chairman, picking up the day after Frank claimed his Academy Award in 1954 and reestablished himself as a top recording artist in music. Frank's life post-Oscar was incredibly dense in between recording albums and singles. He often shot four or five movies a year. He did a TV show, nightclub appearances, started his own record label, and juggled his considerable commercial adventures, which ranged from movie production, the restaurant business, even prize fighter management, along with his famous and sometimes notorious social activities and commitments. And the author James Kaplan has researched and written more than 100 major profiles of figures ranging from Madonna to Helen Gurley Brown, Calvin Klein to John Updike, Miles Davis to Meryl Streep, Arthur Miller to Larry David, Jerry Lewis, and has appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, and so many others. And joining us tonight to talk about Old Blue Eyes himself is the author of Sinatra, the Chairman, and that is James Kaplan. Good evening to you, James.
Good evening, Dave.
What a phenomenal pair of books here. Over the last couple of weeks, I had the pleasure of reading the first Sinatra book, Frank the Voice, an absolutely amazing read. It took you like, a decade to do these two books.
Amazing. 5 years per book. Yep.
Wow. Yeah,
it's a big canvas.
It is.
Just simply an enormous life. What I say is that Sinatra was born in Hoboken in 1915 when horse-drawn wagons were plying the cobblestone streets, just a stone's throw from the 19th century, and he died on May 14th, 1998, the night of the Seinfeld finale. And his life was really the American century. He intersected with so many of the people, so many of the events, and he made so many of the events of the 20th American century.
Well, I'll tell you, these books, though, there wasn't really a definitive biography out there, in my mind, on Frank Sinatra until The Voice and The Chairman came out.
Well, thank you. If you read the previous biographies, many of them anyway, you would never know the guy sang a note of music. And I got started on this when I was finishing up the book I did with Jerry Lewis, and I went to the 2004 telethon, went out to dinner with a bunch of the musicians who were working on the show. We went to an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and everybody got very happy that night. We were all drinking, and they were all men of a certain age, and it turned out they had all worked with Sinatra. So since we were all so happy, I figured, okay, here it comes. And I rubbed my hands and readied myself for the women, the mob, and the fist fights. And their voices all sort of dropped to almost a whisper, and they spoke in awed tones about what an absolute musical genius Frank Sinatra had been. And I thought, isn't that fascinating? Because with these previous biographies, you would never know that. And I needed a new book to do, and I wanted something big, and boy, did I get it.
But what a great opportunity to have these people in one room for you to talk to and really inspire you to get this book going. I mean, that's fantastic.
It really was. It was kismet. It was a wonderful thing.
Now, you have said, and I've seen some other interviews from you before, that Sinatra was really the seven ages of man, referencing William Shakespeare. I mean, he really lived, 300 years in the time that he was on this planet.
Yeah, that's right, with three packs of unfiltered Camels and a fifth of Jack Daniels a day. And 82 years with all of that. It's unbelievable. The life force was so strong in him that I think it just carried him to that finish line. But the last years were very rough.
Now, you talked about his music and the fact that, nobody really did talk about his music. You recognize in this second book, Sinatra the Chairman, that Frank was really at his best in the 1950s when he was recording with Nelson Riddle. That was kind of a highlight for him?
I think you could argue that between 1954, when Sinatra began recording with Riddle and began with Capitol Records, he actually began in 53, from 53 to 64 or so, he produced with Riddle and with other arrangers, including Billy May, Gordon Jenkins, and others, he produced a series of an incomparable series of popular music albums, created a monument that has never been approached.
He was so hot in the 1950s. You know, it was the Oscar, then he had the big hit with Young at Heart.
Yeah.
He had a radio show, which I just, believe it or not, listened to an episode of this on. We have a show called WGN Radio Theater. We listened to an episode of Rocky Fortune.
Rocky Fortune.
I got to tell you, that was cool as a cucumber Sinatra, all Sinatra series, you know?
Yes, it was kind of meta ahead of its time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And he had the Frank Sinatra show on television, and then he was surrounded, as he was for most of his life until he met Barbara, but he was surrounded by just amazing women, I mean, in his life.
He was surrounded by women, and the most beautiful women in Hollywood, beginning, not beginning with Ava Gardner, it actually began with Lana Turner, but Ava was the one he could never conquer, and therefore the one who fascinated him until the end of his days.
Of course. Of course, when there's a challenge,
yes,
you want it more. Of course. Yes. Of course. Yes. And then here comes the 60s. Now, his career hit some rough patches. You talk about in the book where Frank was labeled a living legend, which, you know, can be considered a flattering statement, but one, you know, might not have been the best for him. It was almost like, well, maybe his career is done.
Once the Beatles hit the popular music business like an atom bomb and really blew apart the business as Sinatra had known it. He detested rock and roll, all it represented, all it had done to his business, and he hated getting old. He hated, just about the time the Beatles hit, he was approaching 50. He hated that number. He hated the numbers beyond it. He tried to stay young. He married Mia Farrow, who was 30 years younger than he was.
Not a real great relationship.
Well, it was. I'll tell you, it was an interesting relationship. There was one part of it that was ignored by Sinatra, and that was she was an extraordinary young woman in many ways. She was highly intelligent, sensitive, and very warm, and also surprisingly sexy. She said she always liked to say that her measurements were 20-20-20, but Frank found out otherwise. But the one thing that was important to her that Sinatra could not abide was her ambition. She was an enormously ambitious young actress.
She wanted to work.
And Frank did not want a wife of his to work. And why they couldn't have figured this out beforehand is a puzzle.
What do you think about Ava Gardner? I mean, obviously working. I mean, is that obviously maybe that turned him off to a point where he didn't like that or didn't like to compete?
The striking thing about their marriage was that they married at a point when her movie career was taking off like a skyrocket and his was heading right down the tubes. And that was extremely difficult between the two of them. She began to get sick of him. She got sick of his moping around. She got sick of his being a failure. But she performed that one miraculous act of resuscitation by going to Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures and telling the biggest lecher in Hollywood that she would give him, Harry Cohn, a free picture if he would give Sinatra a screen test for From Here to Eternity.
That's a great
and
story.
Harry Cohn looked her up and down and thought, what else am I going to get for free out of this? And he gave Sinatra the screen test, and Sinatra nailed it.
He did. He absolutely did. You talk a little bit about, a lot about, actually, the many stories of Sinatra and the mob. It's always one of the most things that are talked about. We were talking, actually, before we got the interview started, about Tony Opodisano and Don Rickles, and you know, that was probably Don's biggest punchlines with Frank right to his face.
Yeah.
About Marco Maccananzo, you know, getting hurt and turning on the car and Frank's albums were playing and now that person's a highway. You know, I mean, it was the busting that had happened over the mob. It'd probably been one of the biggest stories at that time. But you talk a lot about the lives of Frank Sinatra and Sam Giancana. They intertwine quite a bit.
they intertwine quite a bit. Sinatra grew up Italian-American in Hoboken, New Jersey in the 1920s and 1930s, and this was a time when Italian-Americans were extremely low on the social scale in America. They were seen as just a half step above African-Americans, and like African-Americans, Italian-Americans were supposed to be happy, singing, dancing people. And in the case of Italian-Americans, happy, singing, dancing people who ate a lot of spaghetti and now and then shot people. So it was a vile sort of race prejudice. Sinatra suffered from it, and he began to see the mafia guys he ran into early in his life and early in his career as Italian-American men of power and Sinatra thought of honor. Well, I think time disabused him of the latter idea, but he always idolized them, just like a little kid idolizes cowboys or football players. Sinatra idolized these mafia guys for the rest of his life. And John Connor was a big part of Sinatra's life, and John Connor was a very, very bad character, but had a huge influence on both Sinatra himself and on the course of Sinatra's life. John Connor was really instrumental, not directly, but a catalyst in separating Frank Sinatra from John F. Kennedy.
Absolutely, and a complete change of political parties, which we'll get to. But he asked Sinatra at some point to intercede with the Kennedys, because he was friends, obviously, with the Kennedys, to get the FBI off his back. I mean, there's some pretty in-depth stories in here.
Yeah. Yes, he asked that, and Sinatra agreed to do it and then went out and never did it. And John Connor got so furious that he seriously considered having Sinatra whacked. But one night he was, shall we say, enjoying a pleasant time with his lady friend Phyllis McGuire. And as he recounted it himself, Sam John Connor was enjoying a pleasant time with Phyllis McGuire and listening to Sinatra, as so many people did while they enjoyed a pleasant time. And John Connor thought, how could I ever kill this guy? How could I ever steal that gorgeous voice?
You know, you say that there was a interview I know you've seen with Johnny Carson and Frank, and he said, you know, when you're trying to make out Frank, what records do you put on?
Yep.
Which was really tough.
And remember what Sinatra said?
Yeah, he said.
You remember what he said?
Well, he said that he listened to some classy jazz. I mean, he joked around about some of his other contemporaries, but I mean,
what he said besides jazz was. And this was about 1976, and Sinatra sitting there with the gigantic disco collars on, and D's, Dem, and Do's talking like that. Excuse me. And he turned to Johnny Carson. He said, "I'm a Daphnis and Chloe guy.
Yeah.
I'm a sunken
cathedral.
Sunken cathedral guy.
Yeah.
He was talking about Ravel and Debussy.
Yeah, pretty wild." Well, stick around. We're talking to author James Kaplan in his first book, Frank the Voice, and now Sinatra the Chairman. And there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
This is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to author James Kaplan and his new book, Sinatra, the Chairman. So there was an extreme turn at some point in Sinatra's life from a political standpoint, being so liberal and supporting Kennedy to being a staunch conservative, and you really detail out the story.
It began in spring of 1962 when President Kennedy was planning a trip to Sinatra's Palm Springs house for some R&R, also known as Sun and Fun, also known as Jackie Was Traveling in India.
Uh-huh.
And President Kennedy was very excited about this trip. Unfortunately, just prior to that trip, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, had called the Attorney General of the United States, President Kennedy's brother, Robert Kennedy, and informed him that the president's lady friend, one Judith Campbell, who had been actually, again, while Jackie was away, paying visits to the president in the White House, had also recently taken up with Sam John Connor. And furthermore, that Frank Sinatra had introduced Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana and introduced Judith Campbell to President Kennedy. And therefore, the attorney general advised his brother that he could not stay at Frank Sinatra's house in Palm Springs. And instead, the president stayed at Bing Crosby's house in Palm Springs. It came out. It was a gigantic public humiliation for Sinatra. He was furious. The poor guy who broke the news to him, he was always long-suffering around Sinatra, was the president's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, the Rat Pack ancillary. Yeah, yeah. And Sinatra never forgave Lawford. And he never forgave Bobby Kennedy. Curiously, he did forgive Jack Kennedy. He never really took it out on Kennedy, even sent him a rocking chair a couple of months after that. But, of course, the president was assassinated. When Hubert Humphrey ran for president in 1968, Sinatra got that old thrill again about the excitement of political power and being close to all of that and began campaigning for Humphrey and cozying up to him. Of course, Hubert Humphrey didn't quite have the charisma of Jack Kennedy, but power itself was seductive. But then Humphrey's guys told the candidate that he really ought to get rid of Sinatra, that it would not help the campaign for the same reasons that Bobby Kennedy told his brother that he ought to stay away from Sinatra. The Sinatra just had too many unpleasant friends, and so Humphrey dropped Sinatra. And what iced it all was, I don't want to get too much into the weeds. There was a guy named Jesse Unruh who was running for governor of California in 1970 against Ronald Reagan. And Unruh had been close to Bobby Kennedy. And despite the fact that Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, Sinatra convicted Unruh by association. There was also a huge amount of political turmoil in the United States in 67 and 68. It began to scare Sinatra, and it began to scare him. It pushed him, as it pushed so many other men of a certain age, it pushed him rightward politically. And Ronald Reagan, whom Sinatra had once derided as kind of a bozo, suddenly became palatable to Sinatra. Sinatra's Democratic friends were horrified that he was supporting Ronald Reagan for president. But once that cat was out of the bag, and Spiro Agnew was shortly to follow.
Well, I'll tell you, that just reinstates the fact that Sinatra, he wanted to be around power. I mean, whether it was the mafia or one of the presidents of the United States or running for president, he absolutely enjoyed those associations.
Power was extraordinarily important to him, and he was able to acquire a lot of it himself, but the associations mattered to him, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, in the early 70s, he was on a farewell tour, but it was short-lived. I mean, you know, did he think it was over in the early 70s?
I think he was tired. I think that he had made a number of albums that hadn't sold, and that in itself made him feel very tired. I think he was beginning to feel sad, depressed, and somewhat irrelevant, and maybe angry about that. Maybe it was a little bit of a temper tantrum hanging it up. I'll show them what they're going to do without me. But after about a year and a half, he began to realize the world needed Sinatra. He couldn't stand that withdrawal from the adulation, and really had to come back. And the whole idea of Old Blue Eyes is back. Nobody had ever called Sinatra Old Blue Eyes. He kind of made it up himself.
That's funny.
But
that's
it stuck.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely. Absolutely did. Well, and through the 80s and 90s, his concert schedule became heavier and heavier. He wanted to be out there filling up the schedule because, you know, as you said, he felt a competitive nature because of, you know, other genres of music that took the spotlight. But in 93, Duets was released, his most successful album. It was a big deal to him to be at the top of the charts again like that.
It was a huge deal to him all his life. Selling records was extraordinarily important to Frank Sinatra. However, in doing Duets, he did something he had really never done before. He overdubbed. In the past, he had very seldom, if ever, sung over tracks, over recorded instrumental tracks. He was a man who revered musicians, and when he recorded, he always wanted to be among the musicians. He wanted to be with them in the studio, looking into their eyes as he sang those gorgeous songs. With duets, he was not only singing over musical tracks, but he was singing these duets along with disembodied voices, people who had been recorded elsewhere. And The result was very seductive to a certain extent. It was so seductive it went double platinum, and that was hugely gratifying to him. I don't know that deep down inside some part of him didn't feel artistically remiss for having done that.
That personally might have not have been his best work.
I'm sure that he knew that his best work was long behind him.
I mentioned to you that Tony Opitasano's joining me next. Frank's close friend is his co-manager for like 26 years, and you quote him talking about Frank and his final performances, and you know, we're talking about February 1995. At that point of his life, he had lost a lot of friends. He wasn't in the best of health, and he sang as capable as he could, but that was really the beginning of the end.
Yes, after February, after that last concert, those final six songs at the Marriott in Palm Springs in February of 1995, he really went home. He had been in failing health and failing mentally for a number of years. He was forgetting lyrics on stage, despite the presence of these gigantic teleprompters with the lyrics in gigantic print. He was still forgetting lyrics. He had a couple of bad incidents where he collapsed on stage, actually.
Yeah, I remember those, man.
And it was getting very rough. But once he stopped, once he went off the road, as bad as a lot of the final concerts had been, he really declined steeply after that. He always needed the adulation. He always needed the audience to buoy him up, to tell him that he really was Frank Sinatra. And the last couple of years at home were not pretty ones.
You write about the end of his life and the conflicting stories that there were out there between Frank's children and Barbara Sinatra. Everyone was pretty much trying to position themselves as being the one that was taking care of Frank and who was there with him really up till the end.
Yeah, there was a lot of ugliness at the end.
Kind of sad, yeah.
It was sad, and there was a great deal of argumentation between Barbara Sinatra and the children about who could be with him. And I think that the children felt that Barbara was actually keeping them away from Frank.
Yeah. And is really, you know, his music really lives on forever. And folks, we just touched the surface of this amazing book and the first book, which was Frank the Voice, the new book, which is Sinatra the Chairman. It is honestly an amazing read, and honestly get the pair to really understand the whole story. Great Christmas gifts as well, and you can get them at Amazon or wherever books are sold. James, what a amazing storytelling in these books, and
so
timely,
so much,
and so timely as well as we celebrate Sinatra's 100.
Well, it is a great pleasure talking about Frank, and a great pleasure talking with you, Dave.
Well, thank you, James. I appreciate that, and happy holidays to you as well.
Same to you.
All right, news is next on 720 WGN.